As we consider Moses here in this passage of Scripture, one of the things that we find with regard to the mountain to be moved is simply this, with saying it simply enough, Moses came to a place in his life where he would have to face it without an Egyptian passport. From his birth, once in the custody and under the supervision of Pharaoh's daughter, all this man Moses had ever known were the schools of Egypt. All he had ever known growing up were his Egyptian neighbors. All he was ever used to was the finest Egyptian delicacies. All that he was ever accustomed to having was the noble ribbon of Egyptian royalty. That's all he knew. And the text that we just read shares with us a truth that he came to a point, a crisis point, where that was no longer acceptable to him. That was the easiest thing, I might add. The easiest thing for Moses to do was to just stay on the lowlands or the flatlands of Egyptian living. But he had a mountain to climb. He would choose rather to be identified with slaves. And it is said here that he forsook Egypt. He forsook Egypt. Now I want you to think with me about that for a minute. We go back into the text. We come to verse number 24. By faith Moses, when he was come to years, refused. Now that's an active motion of his will. He refused. He had a choice. He didn't have to. But he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And what I'm reading here in verse 24 is not only before his feet would be starting to move out of Egypt, in his heart, it was no longer acceptable to him that he would even be called Pharaoh's daughter. Moses, from where I stand, is a man to be greatly admired for several reasons. Almost in every verse we just read here, we see faith, 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 faith. Now we're talking about mountain moving faith. Faith that believes the impossible, faith that believes the illogical, faith that believes what would technically be or perceived to be immovable. So he came up against it here. He refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God. It's an identity problem now. You know, one of the things I believe that he had charge of, or not maybe charge, but responsibility, some degree of oversight over, was all of the people of his own bloodline who were compelled to do menial, slave-like labor for Pharaoh, and Pharaoh, of course, his daughter. And probably day in and day out, as he was out and about among the people, he would see this, and he would see how they were treated. He would understand then that when that time came, when there arose another king that knew not Joseph, and the leadership there in Egypt turned decidedly against his people, when life for them in the labor that they were required to do was made extremely difficult, I believe all that would have a tendency to weigh on him. And so when we talk about the affliction of the people, he's viewing that. And of course, the choice is simple in verse 25. There's the affliction of the people of God versus the pleasures of sin. The pleasures of sin. Now sin does have lots of pleasure. Lots of pleasure from a world's perspective. When I think of Moses and as a man to be admired because he's a man of faith, I also see Moses as a man who is preeminently probably one of the classic Old Testament separatists of his day. A separatist, you see, first of all, is one who is personally separated from sin before he is ever ecclesiastically separated from organizational sinfulness. One precedes the other. And when that does not happen, it really doesn't make any difference, whatever name you might be called. But here he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. And why would he do that? The next verse talks about the word esteem. Esteeming the reproach of Christ. Now the word esteem means to place a value on, to look at something, to calculate, to attach value. And what he did was he valued the reproach of Christ, of the Messiah. Now this is a tremendous concept. When you think of the fact that Moses, I'm not just sure how much more than the basic prophecies of the future Messiah that he would have had in hand or been aware of at this point. But by the Spirit we are here informed that Moses knew something of a Messiah. He knew something of a Creator. He knew something of a God who is preeminently and providentially in control. And he also knew that while the people were there in Egypt and they were serving like they were esteemed very low. They were, and again, we're talking centuries now removed from when Joseph and his brothers and Jacob were there initially. We're talking centuries past that now, to the point where those people now in the land were viewed as a threat by the Egyptian hierarchy, and they were considered probably the lowest of the low. As a matter of fact, if you want to catch a reflection of that notion, that Egyptian, worldly Egyptian concept, you can come to the New Testament and you can look in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, where we see that God specifically says the kind of people that He chooses to use. He chooses to use the base kind of people, the off-scouring. He chooses to use the low-lifes, the dregs of society. That's who He chooses to use. And why would He do that? To confound them which are mighty. To confuse the mighty. Now, I want you to see something else that happened. It is said there that He esteemed the reproach of Christ greater than the riches, the treasures of Egypt. He had had respect unto the recompense of the reward. But there's something else that happened in Moses' life that created a mound for him, if not a mountain. Back in the book of Exodus, if you'll look there, please, in chapter 2. I want you to see this. At the 11th verse, see what happens here. With all this going on around, and Moses' mind now being very flexible, being pressed and molded into a certain thing, here's what happens. Verse 11 says, it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren. He looked on their burdens. He spied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew. Please notice how it is said here. One of his brethren. How do you feel in your heart of hearts when one of your own is being abused? How do you feel? How is it that you feel, you know, each of us put the test here. When Christ is being abused, when He is being ridiculed, when He is being scoffed at, when He is being minimized, marginalized, how do you feel about that? Keep in mind that the concept of the unbeliever in the New Testament said that the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness. How do you feel when people so devalue the death of Christ on the cross, when they debunk the very notion of a supernatural resurrection, and even in light of that also then denigrate any concept of His supernatural return? How does that make you feel? Now for us who are the children of God, it makes us glad and happy. It ought to. But for them around you, how does it make you feel when you share that truth with people and they just turn up their lip at you and smirk? Give you a little wink and a nod, you know, like, well, when you turn your back, they do one of these little. How's that make you feel? You read here that he saw one of his brethren being hit. He looked this way, one way, and he looked the other. And when he saw that there was no man, look what he did to that Egyptian. He slew the Egyptian. Now he took care that there was nobody to witness it. But he was wrong. He was wrong. Bible does say somewhere, I think, be sure your sin will find you out. He said, well, what was wrong with what Moses did? He was just defending one of his own people. Well, you know, there can be a wrong way to do a right thing. Moses chose the wrong way to do what was right. As a man in authority, one thing he did not have to do was slay the Egyptian for it. He didn't have to do that. He said, he hit him in the sand. He hit him in the sand. Something I know, I'm not a sandy type of a guy, but I do know this much about it, that if you let sand sit long enough and the wind blow on it vigorously enough, it shifts. It shifts and it moves. What you may make a pile of sand here, maybe a month or two later, depending on the weather conditions and the wind conditions, that may not be so much of a pile, but a little indentation. Isn't that the kind of a thing that the unsaved man in Matthew chapter 7 looks forward to when he's building his house, where he builds it upon the sand, the dirt? And when the storm comes, as storms will come, we well know that. He who builds his house on the sand has it devastated. And so Moses killed this Egyptian, hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together. And he said to him, oh, by the way, who's doing the fighting today? According to the verse 13. Two Hebrews. Listen, Hebrews get in fights just like Egyptians get in fights. So they strove together, and he said to him that did the wrong, wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? Why did you punch him? The response, who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Moses was by God's design to be the deliverer of the people. But it had to be in God's time and in God's way. And when God's time is not honored and when His way is ignored, then you cannot expect what He wants to do to be perfectly fulfilled in you. What this thing that Moses did to the Egyptian was going to cost him 4 decades of delay. 40 years it was going to cost him. Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou, look what they say to him, intendest thou to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian? Now where would they get that information? Can you guess where they got that information? They got it from the Hebrew that he rescued the day previous. Hey, you won't believe what Moses did to this Egyptian captain of the guard. Well, what did he do? Well, he killed him. He's buried right over there. And so they throw that up in his face. They throw it up in his face. Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. Known wider is what he's implied there. And now when Pharaoh heard this thing, as Pharaoh did, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now, old Moses would be gone from the scene for a long, 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 long time. You say, well, it's too bad that it had to turn out that way. I mean, yeah, but consider, if you're one of the Hebrews working for a taskmaster, is a 40-year delay of any import to you? Would that be of any import to you? Sure. Sure. When we come into the New Testament, in the book of Acts, there's another commentary in chapter 7, just two verses. Acts chapter 7 on Moses' actions here. If you'll look there a moment. Acts 7 and verse 24. It is said that there in the previous verse 23, when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and revenged him that was oppressed, smote the Egyptian, for he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them. Tragically, the last four words of the verse, they understood not. They didn't get it. They didn't get it. Sometimes it takes a mountainous effort to get people out of Egypt. And sometimes it takes a greater mountain to get Egypt out of people. And so here it is that this delay has transpired. But when we come back to what we read there in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11... And please notice what further is said. Hebrews 11 says, he forsook Egypt, fearing the wrath of the king. He endured as seeing him who is invisible. So he's gone. He's gone. Now he's coming back. We read that on the return trip, after all of his interviews with Pharaoh, all of his appeals at God's beckoning, go tell Pharaoh, let my people go. Let my people go. And Pharaoh said, I won't, I won't, I won't. Plague after plague after plague after plague ensues. Moses is in the process of moving mountains. Now, if you look at each one of those plagues from a human perspective, how many of them are mountain-like in the sense that we've been talking? How many of them seem to be something that is, you're going to do what, Lord? You're going to tell me to tell him what? You're going to turn the Nile River into blood? For what point? You're going to bring the flies, you're going to bring the lice, you're going to bring the grasshoppers? What? All of that designed to move a mountain. And God inserted Moses and Aaron into that scene to facilitate the deliverance of the people of the Hebrews out of Egypt. They had been there now for 400 plus years. It's time for them to go. Before they go, however, there's another mountain to climb. There's another mountain. Part of the one of the wedges that God was going to use was going to be the death of the firstborn in Egypt. And so when we come to Exodus chapter 12 and we see verse 21, you're familiar with the story of the Passover. Consider this, if this is not mountain enough for you. Consider this if it doesn't seem logical to you. Consider this if it doesn't seem to be in any way practical or functional. God instructed Moses to instruct the people. On a certain night, you take the blood of a sacrificial animal and you strike it over the lintel and the doorpost and you stay in the house. Because the death angel is going to come in into the area and he's going to take the life of every firstborn creature in the land of Egypt. Why would he do that? Because he's trying to convince Pharaoh to let his people go. And so Moses, again, said it keeps the Passover. Verse 28, through faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he that destroyed the firstborn should touch them. I want you to know, good news here is that because of the placement of the blood and because of the obedience of faith, not one Hebrew in the land perished that night. Not one. And on the other side of that coin, there was not one firstborn Egyptian who didn't. finally on their way out. We read then that the next verse, 29, by faith they passed through the Red Sea. So they get the permission to go. The hundreds and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of the Hebrews are on their way out. And they come to the Red Sea. They are being pursued by Pharaoh, who has a change of heart. And what does God do? You talk about a mountain to move. Here's a mountain of water. A mountain of water. There was nothing else that Moses or the Hebrews could do. If God does not intervene here at the Red Sea, Pharaoh overtakes them. They get hauled back into slavery. Moses loses his life at last. And God's plan of deliverance is forfeited. And the whole scene of world history changes right there at the Red Sea. The whole scene of prophetic world history changes if God does not intervene at the Red Sea. When you look at the passage in Exodus 14, verses 22 through 29, you know the story well enough to know that there came a point when God gave Moses certain instructions about what he's supposed to do, holding out the rod, and as he did, the waters parted. The waters parted. In spite of what the skeptics and the cynics would say to you and to me, that was just sort of a wading pond there at the Red Sea at that time. They could have just walked through that, but that may be plausible except for one reason, one thing. They went through on dry land. And generally, soldiers and chariots don't get embedded or drowned in wading pools. They get drowned in large bodies of water. So when the sea parted and Moses led his people through that place, got them to the other side. Before they get to the other side, Pharaoh and his troops enter in. When everything is clear, the waters come crashing back down, and Pharaoh and his soldiers drown in the Red Sea. I've always wondered why there has not been a mighty archaeological dig on the part of liberal skeptics in that area. Generally, those who are in that scholastic mindset never like to dig where they're likely to be proven wrong. You and I don't have to dig anything. We just look at the scriptures and here's what God said happened. I believe it as it's recorded here. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, which the Egyptians attempting to do were drowned. All that mountain-moving faith that unfolded over an elapsed time period of decades. And finally, it all happened in a rush. And God's people are out. And so they're out. What then do they do? What do God's people do once they're out? Where do we go from the Red Sea? Well, the sad, sad story. And I'll speedily catch it here for you for our conclusion, is that they were given directions by God to go a certain route to wind up at a certain place. There would come a time when God would send a contingent of Hebrews to spy out the promised land for them. And in the course of that spying campaign, Moses would be a capable leader, but there came a time when he would speak, as the psalmist would say, he spoke unadvisedly with his lips. He disobeyed God on a couple of occasions, but one particularly cost him his leadership position. And so as they are winding this all down, before that all happens, God determines another delay is in order. How long, you ask? 40 years. In the course of that time, Moses will pass off the scene. A new leader comes into the area, Joshua by name. and he is accompanied by his right-hand man, Caleb. Those were the two men who came back with a minority report that there, even though the giants were over there, the land is everything God has advertised and we are well able to overcome. But the majority ruled. So they sat. But there came a time, Moses dies, Joshua now is in charge, and now the commandment is to move forward. And they have another mountain of water. They come to the Jordan River at flood stage. And they've got to transit all the people across that floody river. How are they going to do that? Well, memory serves that sometime in the past, says, oh, Joshua, God parted water someplace else. He would do the same thing again. Cross they would go. A lot of things happen in the way, but then they finally come to a place where they cannot go around, can't get over top of it, can't tunnel underneath it. They got to go through it. And that place is Jericho. Jericho. Whenever I hear that, I think of that old Negro spiritual about Joshaphat, the Battle of Jericho. And it keeps rolling over and over and over in my mind. I just love that song. But the text says here, in the 30th verse, by faith the walls of Jericho fell down. Fell down after they were compassed about 7 days. Just to give you, in closing, an idea of that mountain that had to be moved. Jericho was a mountain that had to be moved. And it would have to be moved by faith. How would it be moved? God gives instructions to Joshua. So in Joshua chapter 6, verses 3 to 5, he says, here's how the wall's going to come down. Let me read that to you quickly, and then we will make the application to the message today. Joshua chapter 6, verses 3, 4, and 5. You might want to understand that there's just a little bit of oozing of precise obedience here. Verse 3 says, you shall compass this city. That means go around it. Make a circle around it. Make a lap around it. The men of war. You go around about the city once. Do this for 6 days. 6 days. 7 priests shall bear before the ark 7 trumpets of ram's horns. 7th day you shall compass the city 7 times. Seems like a lot of little minute details here. Why not just a once and for all frontal assault on the city? Well, a minute. I'll give you a minute. The priests shall blow their trumpets in verse 5, and it shall come to pass that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city shall fall down flat. Please emphasize, circle, and underline the word flat. And the people shall ascend up, every man straight before him. Please notice what it says, ascend up. Well, if the walls are down flat, what's this up mean? Keep in mind that Jericho's, as it was situated, was a very, very well thought out fortress on high ground. On high ground. So, and keep in mind that the rough proximity or the rough comparison of the width of the walls would be the width of our building. Okay? Probably about as high as the building is wide. Which is to say that you would have enough to drive a couple of tractor trailers on the rim of the wall around the city. It was not something like you see in Western America back in the days of the cowboys and the Indians, where cavalry built a fort, chopped down trees and put stakes around and made fort. The Indians put fiery arrows in them and burn them down anyway. These were prodigious walls, and they were to fall down flat. Now, even something that big, if it falls down flat, presents a little bit of elevation, a challenge, don't you think? Falls down flat. Please notice again, in this particular instance, when the launch order was to come and the strikes was underway, not one single Hebrew, not one, would lose his life in the battle. Who was behind that wall, you ask? Seasoned veterans, probably the same caliber as Goliath was the one whom David faced or would face. All men of war. But long before Joshua and his tribe ever got there, they had kept hearing rumors about this people and their God, what they did, what their God did to the other kings that were on the other side. Did you hear what they did over there? And so finally, at last, they see the flags unfurled. Here comes the Hebrews. And here comes the Hebrews' God. And the report came back from the two fellows who penetrated the inner wall was that they are frightened in there. Their hearts already melt. And so the instructions that we read there in Joshua chapter 6, you go around that city once a day for 6 days. On the seventh day, you go around seven times. At a certain time, the priest will blow the horn, and those walls will come down flat. You say, well, do you mean to tell me that the decibel level of those horns was so powerful that it reduced the walls to rubble? And say, no. No. God reduced those walls to rubble. God will move mountains that men cannot. If men will obey what he said, if Joshua had dared to be practical in this and say, you know, we're going to need our energy for the fight here. There's no sense going around this place that many times. And when we get to the day before the battle, we don't want to go around there seven times. We're really going to be gassed. If he had taken liberty with any of those instructions, I guarantee you those walls would not have come down. And they would not have gotten around that mountain. And again, the history of the world would have been forever altered by a simple lack of obedient trust on the part of the leaders of God's people. God has a way of doing things. He has a timing and he has a purpose. And it is always wise when we undertake to pray and to move mountains with faith that we understand that it is always wise to obey God in the process of it all. The mountain, the walls of Jericho fell down, and the account here is just laced over and over with obedience to God's word. What evidence do we have that God will look dimly upon disobedience? Right here at the height of victory, the mountain has been removed. One person rises up in the family and disobeys. And he puts something in his pocket that doesn't belong to him. He takes it home and he digs out a little hole in his tent and he buries it over. Buries it over. And the wrath of God comes down upon the people until such time as the little bit of leaven is purged from the lump. What was a great military victory on one day turned out to be an embarrassing and colossal loss the very next battle they faced. And why was that? Because they did not obey God. Mountain-moving faith obeys God and fully and wholeheartedly serves him all the way to the conclusion of the battle. I trust that this will be help and encouragement to you as you face your mountains in life. Each of us have them. And God has given us the means and the wherewithal to be able to deal with them in a way that will honor him. I trust that that will be your case as mine. Our dear Father, our great God, we pray for your help as we undertake to live for you in these days. Very difficult days, Lord. Confusing days. Very confusing days. Frightening on one hand. And very, very imposing. And yet we are so thankful that we can always count on you. You never change. You're never out of place. Keep us in the place that you want us to be at all times for Jesus' sake. Amen.